Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Thomas Lynch. His most recent book is a book of essays called Bodies in Motion and at Rest, on Metaphor and Mortality. He's the author as well of three books of poems, one, the most recent, Still Life in Milford, Gray Malkin, and Skating with Heather Grace. That was his first book. His book, The Undertaking, Life Studies from the Dismal Trade, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Now, although Mr. Lynch is becoming known as an undertaker and funeral director, as a writer, he is a poet and an essayist. And I thought it would be very interesting for us to begin this show by hearing one of his early poems and an explanation of how he came to write it from the most recent book, Bodies in Motion and at Rest. The poem, which you're about to hear, is Venice. It's from Skating with Heather Grace, and it's my guest, Thomas Lynch.
Thank you, Michael. Venice. My wife undressing in the moonlight, sleeve by sleeve. Late duty with our croupy middle son, she got to breathe by coaxing medicine and vapor rub and steam. She yawns and leaves the door ajar for closer listening. Here is how affection settles in. You dream a girl you had in Venice years ago, off-season, and a room with long windows, so the light she stood in nakedly danced as the breeze danced in the drapery, her skin awash in ivory and shadows. Outside, the vaporetti bubble in the water. Late boats to the Lido and the Zattere. Down the hall, a boy turns in his sleep.
Now, the essence of several of the essays in the book Bodies in Motion and at Rest is that sometimes a single word can turn on its own pivot and join two very different experiences. In this case, it's the word vaporetti, the canal boats in Venice, that join via the Vicks VapoRub and the vaporizer to form a continuous memory. And the introduction describes that process. This is Thomas Lynch reading about his poem.
Years ago, I was watching a woman undress. The room was lit only by the light of the moon coming through an easterly window. Everything about this moment was careless and beautiful, except for the sound of a sick boy in the next room, coughing and croupy, unable to sleep. He had his medicine. The vapor rub and steam were bubbling away. I was drowsing with the sounds and darkening images, half dreaming of Venice, the Lido, and the Zattere, the tall windows of a room I stayed in once, awash in moonlight and shadows, longing for the woman I loved madly then. It was that sweet moment between wake and sleep when the dream has only a foot in the door that the day and its duties have left ajar. I wanted always to remember that sweetness, that moment, and knew I could not rise to write the details down. The sick child, the woman's beauty, the moonlight, the steam bubbling, the balance between the dream and duty, between the romance and the ordinary times, because the slumber was tightening around me. And I was searching for a word, one word that I could keep and remember till the morning, one word only, a key, a password by which I could return to this moment just long enough to make a poem, a purse made of words to keep the treasure of it in. And I was fading quickly. My eyes were closed. My last bit of consciousness was clinging to words, then bits of words, and finally only bits of noises. The woman beside me, the boy's labored but even breathing, the bubbling of the vaporizer, which became, in my dream, the vaporetti. idling in the Grand Canal because it was the key, Vaporetti, the password, the outright gift of sound, whose bubbling and whose syllables sound near enough to the same as vaporizer in the next room to let me traffic back and forth at will between the bedroom in Michigan and the bedroom in Venice, and the moonlight and the beauty and the moment awash in ivory and shimmering images.
Thomas Lynch, reading from the introduction to his book of essays, Bodies in Motion and at Rest. Now, in the course of the essays in this book, several times you're given the gift of a word. In fact, in an essay about a long-lived and much-hated cat, you describe having one of those calendar dictionaries that teaches you a word a day, and that word on that day defined that cat, and in a way many of the accustomed attitudes toward it.
Yes, yes. It was a strange word, you know, grimalkin. And I hadn't heard it before, though it appears in Shakespeare. And but, you know, my ignorance of that is encyclopedic. But the word, it fits so nicely, my own distemper about the cat, that I thought this is too good to pass up, and I just began working away, trying to shape the poem around that word. And
in Macbeth, it's one of the witches has a cat who is its spirit familiar,
yes.
And she, after transacting with Eye of Frog and Tongue of Newt et al., she exits shrieking, "I come, Grey Malkin."
Yeah.
And this cat has been, in a sense, a lifelong diabolist, but it's only when that word attaches itself to the cat that, in a sense, the poem and then the essay that you wrote about the poem form.
In this particular case, there's, I suppose, 10 years between the making of that poem and making of the essay about it. And by deconstructing my own sort of history, the essay comes into being. The poem came into being because it was wordplay. It was an effort to say something about, not liking something your child loves in a way that engaged the language. So I had once, as I point out in the essay, written a powerfully unflattering poem about a former spouse, the mother of the boy in this poem and in the essay. And people took it to mean that I didn't like women. It was that woman that I was cranky about, you know. And in the same way with this cat, you know, it's not the feline in general I dislike. It was that cat. So
now that essay did bring me up short to a kind of question. You say in the course of it that Richard Howard, well-known poet and mentor to many poets, suggested, having heard you read the poem, The Execration, The Malediction, on the birthday of your ex-wife, that you no longer read that poem. And you say, in fact, that that one of your children who heard the poem when it was read was very negatively affected by
yes.
it. You say that the poem itself is in a book that is now out of print. It has not been reprinted. It is not in anthologies. You do not read it anymore. And yet, you talk about it and quote from it in this book. So mm-hmm. I sense that there's a kind of double-facedness
yes.
in some of the way in which you regard the viler qualities of the work you've done.
Well, I don't... I mean, I uphold the right of the poem to exist. And I uphold the right of the poet to deal with the entire range of human dynamics. It's not all love poetry, and because life isn't all affection, we are not all being compared to summer's day, you know, all the time. Sometimes there's some upheavals in the weather. But I wanted to write responsibly about the larger issue that I think, for anybody who's been divorced has to deal with, and particularly any parent who's been divorced has to deal with, which is how to broker the distance between your disaffection for a former spouse and your children's necessary affection and attachment to them. You know, for the good of the child, you must do this, but your own sanity requires you at least to acknowledge, you know, less than fond feelings sometimes.
I thought that as well. Within the poem, you were exploring a fascinating form common to the Irish tradition in poetry, mm-hmm. a tradition practiced at weddings and wakes mm-hmm. of cursing.
Yes.
Casting spells on, maledictions. And this goes on like dueling banjos in a kind of racing cascade of rising and intimidating malediction. And that, too, it's a formal idea for a poem. And in a sense, it wouldn't work if it were not, in fact, targeted at an accurate source of rage.
Yes, you can't sort of nature fake your way through those litanies, you know. It's I don't think of it as therapy. But I can remember the first time I aired that piece. I felt good. I mean, people were you know, women were hissing, men were applauding, people were laughing. Some people were just kind of angry. But it was not a neutral reaction, and I thought, that's okay with me. I mean, but I just to have those words in my mouth and out in the air felt good.
I'm talking to Thomas Lynch, the author of the book of essays, Bodies in Motion and at Rest on Metaphor and Mortality. It seems to me, in fact, that finding the center, not necessarily of a controversy, but of a difficult situation, is at the center of your work. That as, in a sense, a funeral director, you are acting on the interface between the technicalities, the behind-the-scenes, the necessities of a funeral, and on the other hand, the need to pacify and heal a difficult situation. And you have in your poems a figure who repeats from book to book, the figure of Argyle, who is a professional sin eater.
Yes.
Well, let's say what a sin eater is first before we proceed.
Well, a functionary of sorts. I mean, a functionary whose job it is to take unto himself in the form of bread and beer and payment, the sins of the deceased. So a kind of secular priest who operated, you know, through, they say, right up until the 19th century in places like Scotland and Ireland and Wales and Brittany, places like that. You know, Celtic countries that had that knew good medicine when they saw it, you know.
Do I understand it correctly that the sin eater would literally eat a meal by the body?
Yes.
And that this was taken to be the consuming, the removing of the sin.
Yes, they would lay the dead man out on a plank or the dead woman out, but mostly men were the best sinners. And they would assemble a meal of bread and beer. And the sin eater, about whom people had hugely ambivalent feelings, would be called, and he would, in a kind of Eucharist, take unto himself, not in bread and wine, but in bread and beer, the evil that had accrued to the, or the punishment that had accrued to the sins of the dead person. That you know, he was paying the freight. He was the scapegoat, you know. And I can remember reading about this figure in a paragraph in mortuary school, in a book by Puckle, a history book of mortuary customs.
Well, this figure who is named in your poems, Argyle, is a repeating figure, much like Crazy Jane in Yeats's poetry. And he seems to be, at least since he has appeared in poems over a lifetime, a kind of crucial figure.
Argyle became for me another exercise in language. Our guile, our guilt, not to mention the sort of trendy fashion and footwear, and you know, that comes from that province in Scotland. So a whole mythology in my own imagination grew up around this character whom I named for a pair of socks because it sounded like the place he came from.
And yet, assembled, they become a kind of...
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.